everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Flicks the Church Forgot. And my apologies for the long delay in getting an episode out. Really, there's just been some general life and work project busyness over the last couple of months. But also, really, the main reason has been my lack of a proper laptop to be able to do any audio editing on. And so I've been a bit stuck with that and doing a lot of things on my iPad, but I can't really edit podcasts on that. But now that has been rectified, and so I've been able to dive straight back in into tonight's episode, looking at a horror movie from 1982. I think that was the same year that E.T. came out, but also the same year that we found The Beast Within.
Warning. This preview cannot show all of the terrifying and grotesque transformation sequences from the last 30 minutes of The Beast Within. The filmmakers strongly suggest that those who may be shocked by this unique, horrifying movie use caution when seeing the film. There's something inside of Michael.
Never seen anything like it before.
Something that's been waiting, watching, and growing.
Michael?
Something evil.
I know you're in here.
And whatever it is ready to be released.
I came back for them, all of them.
And now no one is safe. You have been warned. You are dared to remain calm during the horrifying final 30 minutes of The Beast Within. Even you may not survive. You have been warned.
I love that trailer. It really ramps up the 1950s style exploitation, this idea of you may not survive, you have been warned. And this obsession with the last 30 minutes of the film, you know, I like films that have these gimmicky sort of vibes to their advertising campaigns. And you would think, really, from that idea of just watching the last 30 minutes, that you might as well skip the first hour or so of the film and just watch the end. But you would be missing a lot, because The Beast Within, in its entirety, not just its ending, is a whacked out, occasionally disturbing, and at times really quite hilarious horror oddity. And so I would say, watch the whole thing. Don't just watch the ending of it on YouTube. And I say this is an oddity because, to me, The Beast Within is really quite a weird creature. For a start, it's very handsomely made. It's a big major studio production from MGM with a decent cast and a decent budget, and yet it belies its big studio pedigree to deliver some truly bonkers B-movie exploitation. But more than that, I think it's the story itself that feels really drugged up and crazy. Now, here we find Tom Holland has penned a story that is based on what's interesting, listen to this. It's based on a brief description that was shown in a publisher's catalogue. And the author of this, called Edward Levy, hadn't even written this book yet, but this brief description of a book that he might write occurred in this catalogue. And so Harvey Bernard, the producer — he produced The Omen, by the way — he saw this and liked the sound of this sort of synopsis, and so hired Tom Holland to write a screenplay based on this idea. Now, Tom Holland, I think, is an underrated screenwriter. He created the highly successful and controversial film franchise, particularly in the UK, Child's Play. But he also is behind one of the best vampire movies of the 1980s, which is, of course, Fright Night. And he got his big break when he wrote Psycho 2, which was obviously a much anticipated sequel. A lot of pressure on him, I'm sure, but the film he came up with in Psycho 2, while not nearly as good as Hitchcock's original, is still a really pretty good psychological thriller with a shovel scene I doubt I will ever forget. So Holland here pens the film version of The Beast Within, and he makes the point in the extras that when he thinks back over the story elements that he used, he sort of scratches his own head and thinks, what was I thinking? To be playing around with such bizarre and at times quite sick ideas. Now, what follows in this review of The Beast Within, I guess, are some spoilers, but they're not major ones, and I'd like to be quick to point out that it's impossible to talk about The Beast Within without delving into the darker story ideas, and I'm only going to be sharing that which really is written on the back of the DVD and the Blu-ray. But if you haven't seen the film and you want to watch it completely fresh, then of course I suggest that you don't read the back of the box and you just stop listening now and check it out yourself. But otherwise, press ahead and we'll look more deeply into it. The Beast Within opens, I think, in the 1960s with a happy young couple on their wedding night. They're called Caroline and Eli McCreary, and they're driving through Mississippi, having a lovely time. You know, romance is in the air, laughing and enjoying the springs of wedded bliss. But like all good 50s and 60s young couples, they, of course, have car trouble in the woods. And so Eli has to walk several miles into town to get help. I'm really not sure why he doesn't just lock up the car, and so she walks down with him. That's certainly what my wife would rather do. But no, Caroline waits in the car, and maybe it's because she's got a dog for company and protection that she's willing to do that. It doesn't work, though. Because nearby, there is this old house with a creepy unseen creature in a cellar trying to get out. And for some reason, this creature thing decides to pick this exact moment to break out. Maybe it can smell love in the air. And it stomps through the forest toward Caroline. And now, at this point, you think you're getting the classic horror setup of a monster killing the girl, or at least it's going to grab her out of the car, throw her over its shoulder, and take her back to the old house cellar. But no, this is where 50s B-movie becomes sort of late 70s, early 80s harsh reality movie, because the monster grabs at this lady, tears off her clothes, and it goes all humanoids of the deep, and he rapes her. And you're like, oh, right, I wasn't quite expecting that. Now, you have to appreciate the victim here is Caroline McCreary, played by Bibi Besh. Now, this is Captain Kirk's girlfriend in Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. Khan! And that's the mother of Kirk's son, the son who ends up getting murdered in Star Trek III. You know, the Klingons. You son of a bitch, you killed my son. You killed my son! All that stuff. Can't get enough of Shatner's acting myself. Now, both Wrath of Khan and The Beast Within appear to have come out in the same year, and so she certainly had a varied character arc in 1982. And here we see her being, like, violated by this bizarre creature. And it's not super explicit or anything, but it's also not very subtle either. And so there's a surprisingly grim vibe as the film opens up. Anyway, the film flips to 17 years later, and we find that this horrific night has not only left psychological damage on this couple, it also seems to have left fashion damage on her, because she wears a woolly hat a lot after this. I'm not sure why that's related, but she keeps wearing a woolly hat almost all the time. But it's also left a biological legacy. A son is conceived in the attack. And credit to Caroline and Eli, they raise this kid as their own. They treat him with respect and love, and they don't appear to have had any other children, which is interesting. Maybe Caroline was put off that sort of stuff for life with her forest experience, and who could blame her? Or maybe Eli isn't able to conceive. Maybe they just didn't want more. But either way, they have one son who may not technically both be theirs, but they make him both theirs. In fact, the dad throughout this, played by Ronnie Cox, I guess you may know him best from RoboCop, but lots more movies, he shows a really heartfelt affection for this boy, which is quite touching, I thought, while they refuse to talk about this horrible night that brought him into being. But there's a problem, and we see this all within the first 10 minutes of the movie, as well as the blurb on the back of the box. So the kid has some sort of illness. The doctors aren't sure what it is, but they figure it's genetic. And so the doctors are asking these poor parents, you know, we don't understand. He's got this illness, but you two seem completely fine. Is there any explanation? Poor dad doesn't want to admit anything and fess up that the kid isn't his. He's a proud guy as well as a nice guy. And so he and his wife go back to the town where the rape happened to try and figure out the identity of her attacker all those years before. Now, from a writing point of view, for me, I think this is a brilliant setup for any movie or a novel. It's credit to Tom Holland for coming up with such an effective opener. Because within a very short space of time, you get characters you totally care about, whose motivations make absolute sense, and they are forced into a difficult situation, which actually seems quite natural. If your kid was seriously ill, you would want to investigate his real lineage, if that would help. And that's what they do, and I think it was a killer hook. I liked it. It really drew me in. However, this completely understandable, logic-driven setup starts to deteriorate after a while, until about halfway through this film, The story just becomes something like Twilight Zone on Prozac. In fact, Tom Holland himself admits that the film falls into, and I quote, incoherency, which is quite true. Be honest with you, right? There were points in this film where I just didn't know what the heck was going on. I was like, I'm lost here. But that's okay. You just have to accept that the story is wacky, but it only sort of makes me appreciate how such a strong opening idea that it, you know, devolves into this sort of crazy loony stuff. But that's all right. So the parents are forced to confront the past, but they find that the small town they're looking into, which is called Niobe or something, in Mississippi, they seem very reluctant to help them out. Cue lots of twitching blinds and curtains as people watch Eli and Caroline wandering through the small town asking questions that people don't seem to want to answer. This brings me to one of the film's strengths, I think, and it's the location itself. There is this swampy mist that seems to cover the Mississippi outside shots, so that just watching it for an hour and a half makes you feel really quite clammy. And there's some excellent photography of swamps and moist-looking trees. There's one moment at the start of it which I particularly love. I'm like this, I'm weird, but sometimes there's just single moments in movies that I just absolutely love, and it's just a picture of it, really. It's just a shot, and often it's not the big money shot. It might be just a location shot. The other day, me and my wife were watching TV, and I was flicking the channels, and Zombie Flesh Eaters came on that was on TV, and it just happened to be on my favorite shot of the film, which is literally, I think I mentioned it in the Zombie Flesh Eaters podcast I did, of when Ian McCulloch arrives to get on a boat and he's just near some sort of holiday destination. And I just love the shot. And in this, there's a brilliant shot of this couple driving slowly in their car into this town, and they're stressed with what they're coming to face, and the buildings just seem to brood in the misty corners of this area. It's great. And it's got a very Lovecraftian vibe to it. In fact, Lovecraft crops up in other places too, like the fact that the funeral home guy is called Dexter Ward, so it's no surprise that you get that vibe. But I really love this setting. So many horror movies tend to be set in the dry and sweet small town America, and they are less in murky, swampy backdrops, and it really adds to the vibe. So while the parents are trying to get to the bottom of who Michael's father really is, I should say, we follow the story of Michael himself, who's starting to experience an intense change within him. Now, okay, 16, 17 years old, so he'd probably be going through puberty, or been gone through puberty, of course, by then. But this new change in him is something far more destructive, though the parallels with puberty are not to be ignored. Still, though, we get Michael wrestling with the beast within, something inside of him that is driving him to bizarre animalistic behavior, and a fear of the sound of the cicadas is a really important part of his story. Let's talk about the cicadas for a moment. Just in case you're not aware, the cicada is an insect, usually benign to humans, that are probably best known for their buzzing and clicking noises. You can probably hear them in the background now. In fact, where there are multitudes of cicadas, their humming can be amplified to intense, even overwhelming levels. Now, in the UK, we just don't have this sort of thing. In fact, I always used to be confused when I first saw American movies at nighttime, and I'd hear this strange sound on the soundtrack, and I was like, well, I don't understand what that is. I just couldn't work it out. Then I remember going on holiday into the Austrian Tyrol when I was a kid. And one of my first nights in the hotel, I remember walking out into through the lobby and then, you know, into this sort of the car park area, and I was looking at these dark mountains all around, and I could hear these cicadas or whatever they were, these insects out in the darkness. Now, for someone who never heard this for real, it was pretty creepy trying to figure out just how many of them were out there in the shadows, how close were they, and were they getting closer? So the cicadas become this key idea in the film, which, to be honest, I think is where the logic of the story starts to become a bit unglued. I really don't mind that at all, but it's just this insect stuff. I think that's the stuff that's going to leave audiences saying, like, huh? What? I enjoyed it, and I don't know if it's supposed to be metaphorical or literal, I don't care, but there's this definite confusing and bizarre cicada reference. What's interesting about the cicadas, though, is that the species is famous for disappearing entirely for many, many years. And when they just randomly reappear in force, it can be just, why are they suddenly here? There's a mystery to what they do. I quite like the idea of that. It certainly makes sense in this movie that they're mysterious and unexplainable. But also, I read that the species, some species, can follow a 17-year cycle. In the same way as this happened 17 years after the initial attack in the woods. This cicada cycle, as far as I can remember, is not mentioned explicitly in the film. I don't know why they did that. Didn't do that. That's a good trick. But they didn't. But I loved finding out about that in the background. But what follows all of this is truly bizarre. I'm not going to give away the actual plot, but the trailer itself hinges, as does the posters, on the fact that there are physical transformations in this. And so again, I don't feel it's a spoiler to talk about the fact that there are physical transformations. So what of the last 30 minutes of the movie, which nothing can prepare you for? Well, I would say be prepared to laugh. Because the physical effects are certainly gross and squirmy, but they are laugh out loud hilarious in places. I mean, you know, in the late 1970s, right? And particularly the 1980s, the early 80s, when there was a seemingly perfect storm of horror theory and horror technology. By that I mean there was a fascination with body horror, where the human body and its mutation will be the source of terror. David Cronenberg, of course, is the most celebrated and impressive, I think, proponent of that. But directors like Brian Usner in films like Society from Beyond and The Dentist and plenty others had a fascination with mining this deep-seated fear of our bodies rebelling against us. And so the term body horror came about. It's something that some critics treat with disdain and say it can sound a bit flouncy, snooty, and pretentious. But, I'm all right with it. I think it's a reasonable label to slap on a certain angle of horror. So you have body horror being in vogue around this sort of time, along with the development of air bladder special effects. Now, this was a fairly simple technique where an effects artist would put a bladder attached to a tube underneath latex skin. So you could then get some, like a pump, and be squeezing air into the bladder to create all manner of weird pulsating face and body effects. And there is, without doubt, something quite disconcerting about seeing someone in front of you with a huge pulsating lump on the side of their face. Now, it's a little surprise to find these techniques brought an explosion of transformation effects in horror, from Oscar winners like American Werewolf in London, and to actually what I think I prefer, which is The Howling, to extreme and unsubtle climaxes to films like in something like Amityville 2, The Possession, which for most of its running time runs like a disturbing dark drama, then ends with a bladder-tastic shriek fest for the blood crowd. This is still fun, but what's interesting is I think The Beast Within and Amityville 2 share a sort of similar DNA. They are about dark family dramas, often with a dysfunctional sexualized element that leads to finales with over-the-top transformation sequences. That's certainly what happens in The Beast Within. Incidentally, Amityville 2 I think is a really good horror movie. I should do the Amityville horror film sometime, because I actually really like 1 and 2. Anyway, back to The Beast Within. The director is discussed in the extras as just pushing the extreme levels up so much that the air bladder effects get so bizarre and intense that they slip out of realism and disturbingness and just tumble into laugh-out-loud comedy. I mean, at one point there is this gross moment when the back of this guy's neck is pulsating to such a degree that you actually see two of the coloured air bladders clearly coming through, like with no effects or anything around them. It's just air bladders coming through. Now, the director decided they looked kind of gross anyway, like they were some sort of internal organs coming through, so he left them in. And I love his sort of kudos. He is, yeah, whatever, stick that in, let it go. And he's right, they do look gross, but again, it's so over the top. I quite like that. I think the transformation sequences are what makes this film so fun. But they do rather rub up against the harsh and gritty tone of the opening of the film. In fact, the entire transformation sequence takes place with the Transformer in a... Not Optimus Prime. The one being transformed in a bed while horrified professionals and family look on, and it's not long before you start seeing clear echoes of The Exorcist going on. But with reference to that, as well as the Lovecraftian stuff and a clear I Was a Teenage Werewolf vibe going through the movie, I think it's no surprise to hear that the director is quoted as saying that he wanted The Beast Within to act as a sort of encyclopedia of horror. I'm not sure there's references that are here that are that exhaustive to make it an encyclopedia, but it is at least an interesting pamphlet with lots of different horror references. Another thing that makes the film stand out is the actors in it. Ronnie Cox and Bibi Besh are very good as the main protagonists, but much of the film's got a hinge on the performance of Paul Clemens as Michael McCleary, the 17-year-old who is battling this beast within. Now let's deal with the negatives first. I'm afraid I couldn't help but burst out laughing a few times when he starts to get this beast side out of him. I mean, there's moments, right, when he just starts, like, gurning at the camera and the makeup guy. The makeup guys are like shoved this gum shield thing in to make his mouth look all bloated, and he looks like he's just shoved tissue up there to scare a bunch of kids for a laugh. And then he starts flaring his nostrils and stomping about in his varsity jacket with hands grasping and grunting. It's like got this pantomime unsubtlety about it, which really works for a B-movie vibe, but is just, I found it really quite amusing. Having said that, though, in the general teenager role, he does bring a gentle understanding to it and comes across quite well as a struggling teenager. Indeed, there's a moment where, he begs others to kill him, which is both moving and I thought quite chilling in its own way. Now, Clemens really does feel young and awkward, and I think that's what many teenagers are like. I guess you might remember, I certainly remember what it was like when you're a teenager and you're starting to discover how your body moves through space. I know that sounds odd, but I recently saw a girl in her mid-teens who was asked to stand in front of church and answer a question about a trip she was going on. And as soon as she started talking, her body started sort of lolling around, like all awkward and weird, like she was a sort of, suddenly the puppeteer got a bit drunk. And I thought, I bet you don't move like that in 10 years' time. There is this strangeness about the teenage years of not quite being a kid, not quite being adult. And I think Clemens, while he walks fairly normal, I suppose, he picks up this awkwardness quite well. I think he was in his early 20s when he filmed this. But even though I found him laugh out loud funny at times, I do think he was still quite a good actor, I thought, in this. He also treats his girlfriend in this terribly. I mean, she really should have just dumped this guy early on, but the plot would have been a bit crap if he had. But seriously, I mean, this guy, Michael, just he needs to read the 5 love languages or something, because he makes this girl's life just a complete mess. And he's irritable and psychotic and, you know, anyway, it's not even a mention, like, what's brewing inside of him. So, yeah, he needs to get some relationship tips, I think. Clemens himself actually is a cool guy. He was, he was 23 when he made this, and he also would contribute to artwork to Famous Monsters in Filmland magazine, which is a really, you know, iconic magazine, although I never saw it or got it in America, in England, so I don't know what it's like, but in America it's a sort of a bit of an institution. And he also did makeup effects too, including the low-budget horror One Dark Night, in which I think he did some sort of skeletal-type lady, as I recall. That looks pretty impressive. I remember seeing that film a while ago. But anyway, it's not just Clemens. There's actually quite a cavalcade of acting talent in this. Lots of faces that you're going to say, hang on a minute, I know these guys. One standout spotting I found was R.G. Armstrong, who plays Sarge in one of my favourite horror movies ever, which is the misunderstood and largely ignored Evil Speak from 1983. In that, Armstrong was this horrible, nasty piece of work treating old Cooper Smith like dirt. In this, however, you know, Armstrong's this kindly family doctor, perhaps more in keeping with his true character in real life, because the extras describe him on the set of The Beast Within as being someone who would often be spotted doing crochet and talking about his spice garden. I can't imagine him doing crochet on the Evil Speak set. If he did, it makes Sarge even more scary than he ever was. But all these characters and actors just show that in some ways this is a team movie. I quite like team movies, where it's not just one person battling against the evil, but it's a whole bunch of people. Stephen King seems to like doing this in films, in books and films, I guess. But perhaps my first introduction to the team approach in horror was in Bram Stoker's original Dracula, which has a real, like, a team of people fighting the undead count. Here, there's a bunch of older people coming together to work out how to deal with a young teenager who is really threatening to unravel. everything that has gone before. That in itself is a strong metaphor. There's another few miscellaneous things I like about the movie. For a start, it does that 70s and 80s horror movie thing by having title cards every now and again to designate the passing of time. The first night, for example, then later, the second night. In these sort of bold titles. And in some ways, people would say these are gimmicky and unnecessary, like the narration, you know, in Blade Runner. But dag nabbit, I like them in B-movies like this. They give a sense of theatrical melodrama to it, and I personally thought it was really quite appropriate. I enjoyed it. It also has a moment in it which feels really gory, even though it's not that bad. But it does an interesting thing that I haven't seen done often before, in that it incorporates real-life mincemeat into the scene. There's something really quite unsettling about watching an overweight character in a vest scrunching up mincemeat with his bare hands. I think I've always had a bit of a thing about people with food on their hands, so maybe I'm just into this. Oh, sorry, against this, I should say. But what becomes here is that the horror director here uses the mincemeat as a proxy for the gore. And if you watch the film, you'll see what I mean. It's actually a very effective, if admittedly blatant, technique, which I'm surprised I haven't seen used more often. Maybe you could let me know if there's something I'm not remembering here, but I thought that was quite clever. Also, there's a character with my surname in it. Oh, yes, somebody called Tom Laws. I remember seeing this when I was a kid. And like going, oh my goodness, there are people out there, even in America. You know, I always had this thing about, you know, like starry-eyed about America. Still am a little bit, to be honest. I'm not sure why. You know, somebody in America was called Laws. I remember, you know, it wasn't exactly a seminal moment in my life, but, you know, it was cool nonetheless. But also this, what adds to the vibe is a very good score by Les Baxter. Now, this composer was perhaps most well known for being one of the most prominent composers of exotica music, that being a sort of jazzy lounge style with ethnic instruments and hipster cool voices, and a sort of worldish version of elevator music, which makes it interesting to see how, after being the king of exotica in the 60s, he ended up being so much in demand to write intense, scary horror scores. He puts in this bombastic soundtrack packed with a sort of 50s-style melodrama. And there's a tragic central theme that weaves its way in and out of it all with the rest of it. It's largely made up of intense horror scoring. But, you know, I do think it works. I have the sold-out Entrada release of it, and it's a score that has really grown on me over time, especially since revisiting the film. The reason I looked into this film again, incidentally, was because Arrow Video in the UK have just brought out a new edition of it. And it's a really good release. The film looks good, quality-wise. There's some... Okay, the ropey makeup effects struggle to hide in the brash light of HD, but that's fine with me. I love to see this stuff in high definition. I just love it. And there's an excellent documentary in the making of the film with some funny and candid reminiscing about the production. And there's commentary too. And look, not everyone's going to like the new cover art that they've slapped on there, but as usual, Arrow provide a reversible sleeve if you prefer the original. The film sounds good, it looks very nice too, so I'd say it's certainly worth a look. I think in the US you can get another version of it. I don't know if it's the same print, you know, I just think it is still worth seeking out in whichever way you can see it. So there we have it, The Beast Within, a film that the director Philippe Mora described as the greatest werewolf movie without a werewolf in it. A dark and depressing family drama that falls headlong into a bizarre metaphorical abyss and ends up at the other end as a thoroughly enjoyable freak show, with some interesting themes at its heart, and it's those themes of having personalities, human or indeed inhuman, within us, fighting for control, that we're going to be looking at in the next episode. But for now, why don't you follow me on Twitter at Rev Peter Laws, or join the Facebook group at The Flicks the Church Forgot. But as you do, always beware of the cicadas. And don't forget, The Flicks the Church Forgot.